Welcome to On the Money. We're here to delve into your finance questions and unpack the jargon around business, banks, and big bickies. On the Money is coming to you nationally through the Community Radio Network. On the Money, the buck stops with us. I'm your host, Catherine Zengerer. Coming up on the show, Treasurer Joe Hockey has said we may never have a surplus. We look at what this means for the Australian economy. Also, Prime Minister Tony Abbott flagged a tax cut of 1.5% for business in his address to the National Press Club recently. But is it responsible in light of the current revenue crisis? And banking giant HSBC is facing the music after a whistleblower leaked documents showing it was helping the rich avoid paying tax. We'll find out the implications for Australia. That's all coming up on The Money.
I've said it before, let me say it again. It was a bold and ambitious budget last year. With the wisdom of hindsight, it was perhaps too bold and too ambitious. We did, with the wisdom of hindsight, bite off more than we could chew. But I've listened, I've learned, and I've changed, and the government will change with me. And we will not buy fights with the Senate that we can't win, unless we are absolutely determined that they are the fights that we really, really do need to have.
Treasurer Joe Hockey is under political pressure to step aside. He's being blamed for much of the Abbott government's economic woes, a budget deficit blowing out and the failure to get key spending cuts slated in last year's budget through the Senate. Now, in an extraordinary statement, the Treasurer has conceded he may not be able to deliver his promised budget surplus any time in the foreseeable future. But is this really as bad as it sounds? And what does it mean for the Coalition's key election promise to deal with debt and deficit? Warwick Smith is a research economist for the University of Melbourne and a freelance writer. He told me why he doesn't think the lack of a surplus is the biggest economic problem on the government's plate. And also why Tony Abbott and his Treasurer Joe Hockey seem to be pulling in two different directions right now.
Yes, I think that's certainly true. And they're caught in a rock and a hard place, really, between their previous rhetoric about the Labor government and their profligacy and, you know, the budget crisis and the reality of weakening in terms of trade, as I mentioned, in terms of the commodity prices and a slowing Australian economy and probably the need for both tax reform and the maintenance of fairly strong government spending to stop the economy going into recession.
We've heard a lot about the need to cut back on spending, in particular around health and education, and the need for people to cough up essentially twice through the tax system and then to be making co-payments. But do you think that this is a problem of perhaps the government either not anticipating the impact of those falling commodity prices, or perhaps that they misjudged the political circumstances that they would find themselves in and not being able to get those spending cuts through the Senate?
I think it's multi-tiered, and I think Joe Hockey is only very belatedly coming to the realisation that actually budget surpluses and deficits are largely beyond the government's control. They're much more at the whim of both foreign trade and domestic economic conditions. The reality is that virtually every economist in the country agrees there isn't a debt crisis, a public debt crisis in Australia. There is slightly more of a worry in terms of private debt. The people and companies of Australia are in a much more difficult debt situation than the government is, and that's really discussed.
Why is private sector debt a problem?
It hasn't become a problem yet. It hasn't become a big problem yet, but it just makes our economy that bit less robust. So if we go through downturns and there's very heavy debt burden and heavy interest burden for businesses and individuals, then you're going to push both businesses and individuals into debt stress. When the federal government runs a budget surplus, which is what Joe Hockey is saying he wants to do, not only is he saying he wants to run a surplus, but he wants to maintain a surplus indefinitely. And it's a sort of simple accounting identity, which means it's true by definition, that if the federal government runs a surplus, the rest of the world, so both Australia's domestic economy and foreign economies who deal in Australian dollars, have to run a deficit.
Can you explain how that works? Why a government surplus means private debt?
There are only so many Australian dollars, and they're held. You can divide the economy up, as I said, into the federal government, the Australian non-government sector, and the foreign sector. And if the federal government is taxing more than it's spending, which is what a surplus is, then that means they're taking more money from the other sectors than they're spending into those sectors. And if there are only so many dollars, those dollars have to come from somewhere.
And yet the government's approach seems to be that they want to pursue this road of tax cuts, in other words, reducing the amount that the public or businesses have to pay over to the government and at the same time reduce their spending. They say that is the way to stimulate the economy. But you're saying actually that's not actually a good thing.
There's two approaches, I guess, and the tax cut approach to stimulating the economy is part of what's called a trickle-down philosophy, that if you cut tax to business, then they will have more money to spend and they'll spend that increasing and improving their business and that will result in greater employment, et cetera, et cetera. But the reality shows that in difficult economic times, when you cut taxes, what actually happens is those businesses will hang on to that money or use it to pay down debt. So trickle-down doesn't really work, and certainly there's good evidence from the United States that it doesn't work. What does work is spending by government. But this is a very controversial area in economics.
And it's hard for the Australian public to understand because for so long we've been listening to this narrative about the importance of dealing with debt and deficit. It's been the key narrative of this government. It was a key narrative of the previous Howard government. How can we turn that around in our own minds?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And it puzzles me all the time how the reality can so often be the opposite of what the public conversation is and what the political conversation is. And no more is that more apparent than when it comes to government finances. There's no economist in the country who really thinks we have a debt crisis or really a budget crisis. We have problems. We have some structural problems, definitely, with the budget. And there are lots of different approaches for dealing with those structural problems. A great template for doing that is contained in the Henry Tax Review, which both major parties chose to pretty well ignore because tax reform creates winners and losers, and the losers tend to shout very loudly.
So how do you see them being able to kind of chart these waters between having to maintain this debt and deficit narrative when, in fact, it might actually be impossible for them, as Joe Hockey's just admitted, to fulfil that?
Yes, I think somebody at some point is going to have to show some leadership and explain to the Australian people why we need to increase taxes.
It's as simple as that.
I think it's as simple as that, and that spinning their way around that can only last for so long.
What do you think would happen to the Australian economy if the government does continue on this path of stripping services?
It's almost certain to drive us into recession. We're sort of the envy of the world in terms of the strength of our economy, but the world is not doing that well, so despite being the envy of the world, there are weak signs in the economy. And I think the more that the federal government pulls money out of the economy and spending out of the economy, the closer we'll come to a recession.
Warwick Smith, research economist for the University of Melbourne. He's also a freelance writer. Australia, this is On the Money, serving up finance in one easy bite.
At the heart of our small business jobs package, complementing our work on employee share ownership scheme and our reductions in red tape costs will be a small business company tax cut on July the 1st, at least as big as the 1.5% already flagged.
When Tony Abbott addressed the National Press Club recently, he announced plans to help small business by offering them a 1.5% tax cut. It was a measure he reiterated in his press conference following the failed attempt to spill his position as Prime Minister. And it was a direct appeal to his small business voter base. But is the move appropriate when experts are saying we have a revenue crisis because of tax cuts handed out by successive governments since the Howard era? Will Kouloris talks to tax expert Professor Miranda Stewart.
Well, it will be a reduction in company tax from 30% to 28.5%. So it's not a huge reduction. It's a small advantage. I should point out that actually, although he says that that's what he's going to do, the legislation has not yet passed the Parliament. And so he does have to get that law through the Parliament before it will become binding and available for small business.
Do you think it's likely that he'll be able to pass that legislation with the current political climate?
Well, it's difficult for anyone to say no to a tax cut, I think, in politics. So there might be bipartisan support, or the opposition or independents might support it. However, one of the challenges that the current government has had is fixing this apparently growing budget deficit. And so having a tax cut that will reduce revenue to some extent without having any alternative ways of raising revenue is likely to be a bit of a political challenge. So there might well be some opposition because it's not being proposed with other measures as well.
Senator Nick Xenophon stated today that it's a good idea as SMEs are a key driver of employment. Would you agree with that statement?
I think it's true that there is a lot of employment in SMEs. But not all SMEs use companies. Many of them use trusts and partnerships, and both of those sorts of entities will not be paying 30% company tax anyway, so this tax cut won't affect them. For businesses that do have companies, of course, if they retain funds inside the company, then they'll benefit from that 28.5% tax cut. If they're distributing out to their shareholders, then the shareholders will pick up the difference in their personal income tax. So it's not going to make that much difference for distributed profit. So it really only makes a difference for small businesses that small medium businesses that do employ quite a lot of people in Australia and that retain funds and reinvest them in their business. It will help them.
What do you make of the proposed 1.5% levy on the top 3,400 businesses? Do you think it's enforceable, or will it lead to businesses fiddling the books?
So that's a misleading description of what this is. As I said, the current company tax rate is 30%. So if the proposal, depends on how they propose it, they may just reduce it to 28.5% for businesses under 5 million or 50 million, whatever the threshold is. And retain the 30% company tax rate for all other businesses, or they may be going ahead with this idea that they reduce the company tax rate across the board for 28.5% and then they impose a 1.5% levy on large corporates. It's very unlikely it will change behaviour, to be honest. These large corporates are already doing as much global tax planning as is feasible for them, and they're also paying a fair amount of company tax. So I don't imagine that they'll be suddenly having lots of separate small companies that pay a lower rate.
The Greens, among others, have proposed a tiered company tax system. Could you explain how that would work?
It just means different rates of tax for different size businesses, and you would work out the size by some measure. So, for example, turnover. You know, we have thresholds in the payroll tax in our states where a certain amount of tax is paid, a certain level based on the wages bill of the company. Some other countries do have a tiered company tax. Really, you know, a company's not a real person. It's an intermediary. So there's not really any justification or plausible justification for having differential company tax rates. It's different from the personal income tax, where you have individuals who have different capacity to pay. In a company, you're just withholding the tax as a proxy for taxing someone else, the shareholder or consumers or something like that. I don't really support a tiered company tax system. It adds complexity.
That's what I was about to ask. So this isn't a fairer model, in your opinion?
Well, there's no... not really. The concept of fairness in terms of progressive rates does not really apply to companies. It applies to real people. And so we should think about fairness in the personal income tax. But having a lower tax rate on different size companies is not really a measure about fairness. If one was to do it, you might do it if you thought it would simplify the system, or you might do it to encourage people to use the corporate form, to use a company for their activity. In the UK, they had a zero company tax rate for very small companies, and all that meant was that lots of individuals set up their services inside companies, and there was a significant avoidance and planning opportunity.
Is it wise for the Abbott government to be suggesting tax cuts when economic experts are saying we have a revenue crisis?
Well, that's the issue, really, isn't it? I mean, as I said, for SMEs, the company tax usually operates as a withholding system for distributions to individuals, individual shareholders who are then taxed at personal rates, and they get the franking credit for company tax. It means there's less tax withheld from the company itself. Most company tax revenue comes from large corporates. So if they are extending the tax cut to smaller or medium-sized businesses, there'll be less of a revenue drop. But it does seem not sensible to push ahead with a tax cut for one sector when individuals and welfare recipients and the population more generally is really being told that they have to rein in their belts and worry about this growing fiscal deficit.
So on that point, then overall you would think that the cuts, even though they might stimulate growth in the economy and make life easier for SMEs, it's probably not the best method of encouraging growth in the economy?
It seems to me it's marginal. It's very hard to see that a company tax cut from 30% to 28.5% is going to stimulate, for only the SME sector, is going to stimulate a lot of economic activity. Tax cuts are a fiscal stimulus, but it's hard to see that this policy, rather than others, is going to make a really big difference. I would rather see the government pursue its tax white paper process and think about reforming the whole of the company personal income tax and consumption tax system overall with the goal of economic prosperity.
Professor Miranda Stewart, Director of the Tax and Policy Institute at the ANU, speaking with Will Kalouris. Around Australia, this is On the Money, serving up finance in one easy bite.
And now it's time for Junk the Jargon. Headline inflation. The Reserve Bank of Australia announced that interest rates will remain low. Before that news, though, I read this press statement.
The headline inflation, currently at 1.7%, should remain below the RBA's 2 to 3% target range in the short term, given the dramatic recent decline in oil prices.
That comment came from James Morley, Professor of Economics at the University of New South Wales Business School. I had a chat with him to try and get some things clear. And just junk that jargon. Inflation measures the prices of many goods, household goods, wages, oil and petrol. But why is it so important to measure inflation?
When we observe a change in prices for a specific good or service, is it changed because that good is now more scarce, which would imply one response, or is it changed just because all prices are going up? And there was the Queensland floods and the price of bananas spiked up dramatically a few years ago. That showed up in inflation, significant increase in inflation, because that's one of the items that is measured, the price of it is measured as a representative of what a typical household buys.
So why do we make it complicated by having a phrase such as headline inflation, which I understand generally is at 1.7%?
The overall inflation was 1.7%, and that's what would have typically been the main number reported in headlines in newspapers. So that's where the terminology comes from. The point of making that distinction of saying headline inflation rather than just inflation is that the RBA in particular and many central banks try to look at other measures of inflation that strip out volatile price changes in things like bananas. You can have some food prices or energy prices that are quite volatile. They want to look at what they would call underlying inflation. And alluding to that, the RBA was saying that they were not cutting interest rates because headline inflation was 1.7% and therefore below their band, but because they were actually worried about not inflation. They were worried much more about unemployment. That's the key distinction in terms of headline inflation versus underlying inflation and why it's relevant for monetary policy.
So there, headline inflation is about what the media usually reports in their headlines. That's all it is. It's an estimate, not the real figures yet. The RBA, who announces whether interest rates go up or down, is more interested with the real figures, the underlying inflation, to be able to plan the economy more accurately. And this last interest rate rise remained low because the underlying inflation is healthy. It's at 2.1%. Headline inflation, you junk the jargon this week with me, Anna Maria Reyes.
Thanks to Anna Maria Reyes for this week's Junk the Jargon. You're with Catherine Zengerer here on The Money on your community radio station. A global scandal has emerged after it was revealed banking giant HSBC allegedly helped some of the world's richest people avoid paying tax. Account holders include royalty, tycoons, athletes, drug dealers, and celebrities. The data shows hundreds of wealthy Australians were among those holding secret Swiss bank accounts, including Kerry Packer and Elle Macpherson. The leaked documents claim the London-based bank's Swiss division helped clients in more than 200 countries evade taxes on accounts containing $152 billion. As business editor Nassim Kadem explains to On The Money reporter Will Kalouris.
So the International Consortium of Journalists says HSBC, which is the bank that people used to hide their assets about a decade ago, had almost 500 clients in Australia. These 500 clients had more than 850 accounts and total combined holdings of $1.24 billion.
There were some high-profile Australians involved in these revelations. What can you tell us about them, and does the ATO plan to take any action against them in relation to this?
The high-profile Australians that were named in the ICIJ documents included media baron Kerry Packer, model Elle Macpherson, and former ANZ chairman Charles Goode. It's important to note that the ICIJ says on its website, where it reveals all these people, that they were not necessarily doing anything illegal, and it isn't illegal to actually have accounts in Switzerland, but it is illegal not to declare them. It seems that most of these people named had declared their accounts in some jurisdictions and that they've, in any case, closed their accounts since. For example, Goode said his had been sitting dormant for about 25 years. On top of that, the ATO also got information separately about 261 HSBC Swiss bank accounts that were held by Australian taxpayers, and it did some reviews and audits in relation to these and says it got back about $30 million in liabilities. And the tax office, separately to that, also ran an amnesty where people could declare hidden money and assets and not face harsh penalties, and much of the money recovered. So far, there's been $240 million in income and $1.7 billion in assets. So a large chunk of that money had come from accounts or assets held in Switzerland.
Would you say that it was a just outcome, considering that the wealthy people involved were able to avoid punitive action based on their tax liabilities? And is the amnesty provision still available?
Yeah, I mean, when the amnesty was announced, there was two points of view at the time. One was that, and this was the view put forward by a lot of the tax advisors of wealthy people, that it was actually just a chance for the kids and grandkids of migrant families who'd come here. And, you know, back in the day, it was kind of quite normal to stash money in Swiss bank accounts. So it was like a chance for them to clean up the sins of their parents. And then there was another view put forward that, you know, well, this kind of condones tax avoidance and we shouldn't be giving these people another amnesty, because there had been amnesties offered in previous years. But all that aside, the ATO, the Tax Commissioner Chris Jordan, had said at the time, look, this is the last ever amnesty we're offering. We won't be ever doing this again, because we're now getting to a stage where the sharing of information is so common. They recently updated a treaty with Switzerland. Globally, there's a big project where they're looking to do automatic exchange of information. And this basically means that tax authorities will get detailed information from financial institutions around the world about various accounts held. So all this will really make it much harder for people to hide money and assets like they used to be able to.
What do you make of the fact that this investigation was essentially conducted by an independent investigative journalism body? And do you think that they play an important role in uncovering instances such as these that the public might otherwise not be aware of?
Yeah, without a doubt. The investigation was done by, as I mentioned, the ICIJ, and they're linked to the US-based Center for Public Integrity, and they listed, I think, more than 140 journalists from 45 countries. The organisation was actually set up with the purpose of revealing corruption and bribery, and it's also behind much of the recent revelations regarding Apple and other multinationals shifting profits to low-tax jurisdictions. So it plays a really, really crucial role, and I'm sure we'll see a lot more to come from them in the coming months.
Business editor for Fairfax's Business Day, Nassim Kadem. She was speaking with Will Kalouris. The HSBC files link almost 500 clients to Australia with 856 accounts and total combined holdings of about 1.24 billion Australian dollars. The ATO says it was already aware of 261 accounts and will continue to take action on those taxpayers who fail to pay the right amount of tax. They're encouraging those with undeclared assets and income to come forward now. HSBC is under formal investigation for tax fraud by French police. In 2012, HSBC paid a record $1.9 billion fine in a settlement after a US Senate investigation found it was used to launder hundreds of millions of dollars for Mexican drug cartels. That's it for On The Money this week. You can find us on Twitter at onthemoney2ser. So follow us and send us your story ideas. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks this week to reporters Anna Maria Reyes and Will Kalouris. On The Money is produced by me, Catherine Zengerer. Thanks very much for your company. Hope you can join us next time.